Hello and welcome to another episode of the Steel and Punter Podcast. Today, I want to talk about something that is very concerning for me with the potential court cases that are out there right now. And I want to talk specifically about payment caps. So payment caps is something that we have not had to worry about since like 2019 at the least. And this is something that I think a lot of people just don't think about. I don't think a lot of people are aware of the problems that are involved with this and the potential consequences that could exist for people that are on an income-driven repayment plan. I don't think this is worth worrying about as of yet, because we don't have any rulings yet, and we will at some point. So I just wanted to talk through something that you need to be aware of, just so that we can be prepared to potentially even have to advocate as a group for big changes that might need to happen, depending on what courts decide to do with IDR payment plans. So let me set the stage. Of course, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably aware of the lawsuits against the SAVE plan that President Biden put out there. The SAVE plan has no payment cap. It's just 10% of your income over 225% of the poverty line. If you have graduate degree, and then if you have undergrad, theoretically, it'd be 5%. If you have some of each, it's a weighted average. The fact that it doesn't have a payment cap makes it a little bit easier to administer, because let's look at IBR and pay-as-you-earn. Those two plans do have a payment cap, and the payment cap is the standard 10-year amortized amount, and it's the greater amount of when you entered repayment for the first time or when you applied for a income-driven repayment plan. So let's say that you were in and out of forbearance a whole lot, and then you finally applied for an IDR repayment plan after accruing a ton of interest. Well, if you accrued a ton of interest, that payment cap is a little bit higher because your balance grew. Versus if you applied for an IDR plan immediately, you know, after graduation, then that would be just the standard 10-year plan after graduation, whatever it would take to pay that off. So a lot of people don't understand what a partial financial hardship means. A partial financial hardship is what's required to qualify for pay or IBR in the first place. And a partial financial hardship simply means that your calculated IDR payment under the pay or the IBR plan is lower than the standard 10-year payment amount that you would have as a cap for those plans. So for an example, if you have $200,000 of student loans, the cap is usually roughly 1% of the balance you owe. So that's about $2,000 a month. So if you have $200,000 of student loans, your pay or IBR payment based on your income needs to be less than $2,000 a month for you to be able to qualify for the IBR plan. Generally speaking, what happens is a lot of people in the past, they would get on to pay or IBR in training or right after graduation or in residency or fellowship or something, and then their payment would go way up because their income would go way up. And in some cases, people might have $100,000 of student loans, but they might have a $300,000 attending salary. And what would happen is under the IBR or the pay plans, their payment would get capped and they would only pay the maximum of that 1% of their balance, even if their income is way higher than their loans. And what that enabled people to do is still get loan forgiveness under something like PSLF, even if their income was just way too high. You know, in most situations, you would think it's too high to get forgiveness. It's impossible, but it's not, because the IBR and pay plans have the payment cap. Now, if you had been on something like the old repay plan or the new SAVE plan that has no payment cap, your payment would go way above that 1% roughly of the balance that you have. And that would make you possibly pay off the entire loan balance before you even get any forgiveness. So now let me explain why I'm concerned. Let me explain why payment caps are a great serious concern of mine with all these lawsuits going on. So if you have the SAVE plan under threat and it's going to get thrown out probably, so then that means what is the post SAVE plan reality that borrowers experience? The 400 pages of regulations that the Department of Ed wrote when they put out the SAVE plan stopped ICR in pay. So it's really only IBR and the SAVE plan at the moment. And so let's say that SAVE gets trashed, right? The question is how far do the courts go? What I mean by that is, let's say they just say that SAVE's not allowable, and let's say the courts also say that you can't get forgiveness under any ICR-derived plan. So ICR-derived plans would mean ICR and pay. So maybe you can get qualifying credit on those plans towards forgiveness, but maybe you can't actually get forgiveness on those plans if the court takes the most extreme view. And if they did that, in a world where it's an only IBR world, here is what I'm concerned about. People have low payments that they have not recertified for years. The Biden administration and Biden-Harris administration has really made sure that there's no payment recertifications going into the election, for the most part. And a lot of politicians would do that. You know, certainly Trump extended the pause right before the election because he didn't want to have a bunch of bills go out to people. So this is sort of a natural politician type behavior, I think. what is the consequence of not recertifying your payment or not having to recertify your payment? Well, first off, a lot of people switched onto the SAVE plan because their servicers told them, hey, that's the best plan because that's what the administration told everybody to do, right? So they left pay or they left IBR for SAVE because it was a lower payment because that's what everybody said to do. Other people were forced against their will to switch from the SAVE plan. A lot of people checked, let my servicer choose the payment for me. And the servicers, if somebody wasn't on IBR, just switched you automatically over to SAVE. And the reason there is because they took away the capitalization of the interest when you switch payment plans. And that's what used to prevent servicers from switching people off of one plan onto another, is because it would capitalize the interest and the servicers didn't want to be accused of doing that. So they would never change people's plans. Well, what did the Biden administration do? They came in and wanted to make a plan that was so good, so generous that everybody would switch to it. And the very few people would actually pay back the full amount of their loans that they borrowed. That was intentional in the plan design because they couldn't get cancellation through. And so this was truly a way to make payments affordable for people, but it was also a way to help borrowers pay less for their college education because there's no way they could pass free public college with the Senate the way that it is. So they tried to do this, and in trying to switch everybody over to the SAVE plan, they took away a lot of the barriers to try to just streamline this, right? Now, in the statute, it's required to capitalize your interest if you leave IBR for different repayment plans. So they couldn't force people out of IBR into the SAVE plan. But if you were on, you know, the repay plan or the pay plan, it was just easy, right? Because if you check that box, hey, let my servicer choose my plan, they would just move you into it. And so let me explain what I'm worried about. If you have a payment of $300 a month, let's say you're a resident or fellow at the time or something like that, or maybe you just maybe recently graduated school and you had a part-time job, or you did a clerk year, or you know, you did a vet internship or a pharmacy internship or whatever it is. Let's say your payment was $300 a month, and now let's say your payment would jump a ton if you had to recertify your income today, because your income is way higher than what it was in 2018 or 2019 tax returns when you last recertified this. If your payment would get massively higher, would go massively higher with the recertification, what happens if the IBR plan is the only game in town because of lawsuits at the end of the day when the dust settles? And what happens if you no longer have a partial financial hardship? What happens if you are not able to get onto the IBR plan because your IBR calculated payment is actually higher than what the standard 10-year plan is? What happens if that's the case? Well, if that's the case, and IBR is the only game in town, there is a risk that there is no PLCLF qualifying payment available to borrowers. This is less of a risk for people going for the 20 and 25 year forgiveness route, because if you no longer have a partial financial hardship because your IBR payment is higher than your standard 10-year amount, you know, you wouldn't have much to forgive anyway, probably. But I'm talking specifically about people that would need to switch into IBR, just to be clear. If you are already on IBR or pay, then what would happen is probably regardless of which way these lawsuits go, your payment would just get capped when they have you recertify your income next. What used to happen is the servicers would send out a very misleading piece of mail saying, you no longer qualify to pay based on your income, call us so you can switch your plan. It's a terrible mailer, such an idiotic mailer they would send out, and it would induce people to switch off of the plan that capped their payment into a plan that didn't. It was just absolutely stupid, absolute stupidity. But they would send this out, and they would send out this mailer that would freak people out. So first off, if you ever get a mailer like that, don't freak out. If you're on IBR or pay and it caps your payment, just ride it, right? But the people who have switched over to SAVE, who have those low payments, who are trying to get especially the 10-year PSLF forgiveness, that the big concern is if they take everything away but IBR and you have to recertify your income, if you are placed over that partial financial hardship threshold, then you would not be able to switch from SAVE to IBR. And you would not be able to get forgiveness at all. That is the concern that I have here. And so if something like that were to occur, let me explain what I think would happen. I think we would need to help everyone advocate. I think that we would have to be a lot more involved than we have in the past, helping people figure out how do you contact your senator or congressperson's constituent services office? How do you potentially fight for getting access to a plan that doesn't have a payment cap on it so that even if your payment is a little bit higher than that standard 10-year cap, you'd be able to at least get a few more years of qualifying payments to get forgiveness of some amount? I do think that the most likely world is they preserve the pre-COVID status quo. I do think it's most likely that we return to pay, repay, IBR as the options available to borrowers after all of this court stuff is said and done. I do think that's the most likely outcome. But the Eighth Circuit, which is this conservative appeals court that's hearing the save plan challenges, has shown hostility to ICR-derived income-driven repayment plans. And the reason there is because that is the one statute that lets Democratic administrations are the only ones that have used it to create IDR plans. That's the only law that allows Democratic administrations to say, hey, we can make super generous payment terms because this law is ambiguous, so we can do whatever we want. So I think that's one of the reasons why this conservative appeals court is so hostile to any ICR-derived forgiveness plan. And ICR versus IBR, they're two different statutes. The ICR statute says you can have borrowers pay no more than 20% of their income, no more than 25 years until forgiveness. So Democratic administrations have always looked at that as, hey, that's our lucky day. We can make anything we want. Whereas IBR statute, that was written by the Obama administration and, you know, Democrats during that administration, during the Affordable Care Act legislation. And that was very clear. The formula is 15% of income for 10 years for PSLF, 25 years if not, if you borrowed before 2014, and if you borrowed for the first time after 2014, then it's 10% of your income for 10 years for PSLF and 20 years if you're doing private sector forgiveness. So the IBR statute is explicitly defined. It's very clear as to what it is. The ICR statute is loosey-goosey all over the place. It can mean anything you want, depending on who's reading it. This is what we need to be following with these lawsuits is, did the Biden administration, in its desire to be very loud and very public about the SAVE plan, in its desire to force everybody into the plan, in its desire to make a plan that was so generous that everyone would want to switch to it? I think what might occur here is we might generate a ton of problems for borrowers because of all the downstream impacts of the Biden administration not being quieter about this. I mean, to be honest, I'm just going to kind of tell you my two cents on this. A lot of times I try not to, but like, think about the IDR account adjustment and the PSLF waiver. It was done quietly. It was done in a muted way. The press release significantly understated how good it was. The press release for some of those adjustments and the waivers said it will help at least a couple million borrowers with at least a couple billion dollars. The same kind of tricky language that's in the ICR statute, right? At least a couple million borrowers, at least a couple billion dollars. It ended up being a huge order of magnitude above that. But they got it through because they were quiet about it, because they didn't brag about it, because they didn't automatically sign everybody up for it. And because it was less than a projected $100 billion, it would have drawn more attention, right? But when, you know, you take the SAVE plan, they had consumer advocate groups pushing for 400% of the poverty line. And more than half of borrowers in the SAVE plan pay $0 a month. So if you'd done 400% of the poverty line, something like 75 or 80% of borrowers probably would have payments of $0 a month. But because they went so big, and I think in particular because they were so loud about it, we've drawn, you know, a political incentive for, you know, Republicans seeking higher office to sue to try to block all of this because they think there's a political reward for doing so. It's very frustrating. But I will say, let's not panic. Let's not worry yet, because we still have a long way to go before these lawsuits get resolution and before we find out exactly what they're going to do. And then those lawsuits are going to get appealed to the Supreme Court. So just to be clear on the timeline of things, I do think that if we have a Trump administration, I think that what we're going to see is they'll probably just accept whatever that lower court ruling is with a more conservative court and not appeal it to the Supreme Court. And then we might have all this finished by January. But if you do have a Harris administration, then I think, of course, that her administration would defend the SAVE plan and appeal it to the Supreme Court. And possibly what might happen is that Eighth Circuit decision might become a little bit less conservative. I know that you might think that's crazy, Travis. What are you talking about? You know, the Supreme Court's so conservative. But the Eighth Circuit's actually more conservative in terms of its makeup than the Supreme Court is. And so the Supreme Court might walk back some of that stuff, especially if there's a bunch of problems that happen the Eighth Circuit's just completely unaware of when they make their ruling about things like pay as you earn or, you know, ICR derived IDR plans or, you know, these payment caps that I'm concerned about. If there's some really bad things that happen in that Eighth Circuit ruling, then if you have Harris win, that she would probably sue to appeal it to the Supreme Court, try to protect the SAVE plan and at least get a little bit less extreme kind of outcome possibly. So that's what we're waiting for, guys. We're waiting for this election to see which way a lot of this stuff with student loans is going to go. You know, if you would be impacted, if there was a change in the state plan where partial financial hardship was required to be able to access IBR, which would be required to access PSLF, we're going to be looking out for you. We're going to be looking for every backup plan, every loophole, everything we possibly can to look out for you to make sure you don't have to worry. Because again, we're just analyzing this stuff all the time. And we're seeing stuff in the regulations, frankly, reading them very, very carefully that we have not had to think about in 5+ years. Again, if you think about things like the standard 10-year plan and getting onto that plan and just things like that, you know, we have not had to think about that for a long time, right? A very, very long time. And a lot of the servicers are brand new. And so the way they interpret the regulations is new as well. And so we are just running into all kinds of interesting things where we just have not experienced people having to make large payments that are fully based on their most recent taxable income. And we haven't had to do that we haven't had to do that yet in this post-lawsuit world with whatever they're going to decide. You know, I know it's a challenging time. If you have questions, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail and record one. And we'll cover it in a future podcast. And then if you just know that you need your save, repeal, backup plan customized for you, go to studentloanplanner.com/book. Thank you, everybody, and have a great rest of your week.